From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And Jeremy, acknowledging how we are impacted by the news, the Bobcat Fire burning in the Angeles National Forest is about 5 miles away from me here in Pasadena. So we're under an evacuation warning. We don't have to leave yet, but we definitely have our bags packed.
I can't imagine. And I think so many of us in the Northeast get a sense of the magnitude every time we look up at the sky and see a haze over the sun from the smoke coming from thousands of miles away.
Yeah, it's incredible. And that fire that I mentioned is just one of dozens burning right now in California, which means a lot of work for firefighters. Daniel Berlant is Assistant Deputy Director at CAL FIRE, the state agency fighting the fires, and he joins us now. And Daniel, can you start with the big picture of what's happening with containment? What are you watching for today?
Well, we are continuing to see dry conditions, even though we are now in fall. Or getting close to fall, conditions are still very dry. Fortunately, we are not experiencing the significant winds that we had over Labor Day and back in August when many of these fires ignited. But we really just continued for now over a month battling fire to fire. Over 17,000 firefighters here in California on the front lines of over two dozen major wildfires.
17,000 firefighters, two dozen fires. Can you put this fire season in context compared to past years?
We've had more acres burned this year than any other year before. We have burned almost 27 times more acres to date than last year. And that just goes to show you that dry conditions, unhealthy forests, and a number of other complexities continue to lead to more destructive and much more larger fires.
I know it is a very sophisticated and complex job having 17,000 firefighters who are working, but can you give us a window into what their jobs are like? How long are they working? I can imagine it's dependent on which fire they're on.
When these fires ignite, the first several days is a nonstop battle. Sometimes our firefighters are working 48, 72 hours straight on the fire lines, catching a little nap here or there. In order to just continue to save life, we have to keep our firefighters going for multiple days. Once we can get additional resources at scene, then we start rotating our firefighters. And so we get into a routine of 24 hours on the line, 24 hours off. But many of our firefighters have been assigned to these incidents and have been away from home for well over a month. And unfortunately, there's no end in sight right now.
Can we talk a little bit more about resources? Washington State's forester told the Associated Press that there are hundreds of unfulfilled requests for help, whether it's more firefighters, aircraft, or support personnel. How is California doing in terms of those resources?
Well, while we are continuing to request additional support and even see additional support from some other states, even as far away as New Jersey here in California, in California, we are fortunate that, we experience wildfires every year. It's not a surprise. And so we have a huge amount of resources to draw from, not only having a unique part where, the state's fire department, us, CAL FIRE, we are the largest wildland firefighting agency in the world, but then we have so many cities and county fire departments that we can draw upon. Then you add those western states that are supporting us, the other federal agencies like the Forest Service, BLM, the National Park Service. And then on top of that, activating our California National Guard and even National Guards from other states who have come in to support the California National Guard. Many of those Guards members on the front lines as fire crews, and some of them flying helicopters, dropping water on fires. Even going into this year's fire season, the state invested more money in additional firefighting positions, and we've been working on adding more equipment, replacing our helicopter fleet, adding C-130 air tankers to our already existing air tanker fleet. So in California, we are fortunate to have so many resources, but under these extreme conditions, we have to rely on our federal and other partners to aid us in battling these fires.
So what are you in most need of right now?
Cooler weather. The weather is the key factor right now. It's the wind that fans these fires. It's the fuel on the ground that, when conditions are dry, burn at just explosive rates. We are definitely making progress. A number of fronts, we are very close to containing several of the major wildfires that ignited last month. So in some areas, we are making good progress. And as progress is made, we'll move resources from one area to the other.
Daniel, that sounds really scary, though. I mean, you're dependent on a factor that you don't have any control over.
Weather is the most important factor on a wildfire because it is going to dictate the fire's behavior and even the fire's direction. And like you said, we have no control over it. However, we have meteorologists, we have fire behavior experts on hand that help us do the best we can to use science to really forecast and predict what the fire behavior is going to look like.
That's Daniel Berlant, Assistant Deputy Director at CAL FIRE. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The election is more than 6 weeks away, but early ballots start to go out in the key state of Florida in just a week. Democrats in the state are worried about polls that show Joe Biden underperforming with Latino voters in the state. USA Today Miami-based reporter Alan Gomez joins us now. Hi, Alan.
How's it going, Jeremy?
Going well. So Biden had a lead in the polls over the summer in Florida, but the race is now pretty close with just a slight edge for Biden. Would you say that that is largely because Biden has been struggling with Latino voters in Florida?
Well, I think to some degree, I mean, a Florida presidential election is just always going to be close, right? But yeah, those numbers that the Biden camp is seeing among the Hispanic voters here, that's part of the reason that it is as close and remains as close as it is. Understand, Hillary Clinton won Florida Hispanic voters by 27 points. Biden's at 16 points right now. And that's a very big drop when you consider that Hispanics make up about 16% of Florida voters. And yeah, so they've been really starting just in the last couple of weeks to make a bigger push.
Well, when Biden was there on Tuesday, he promised Latino voters that he would build on Obamacare. Let's listen.
Under the Obama-Biden administration, 4 million Hispanic Americans gained coverage, the largest gain of coverage of any group. But President Trump is still trying to rip Obamacare away from people in the middle of the worst pandemic in a century.
So he's talking about health care there, but aren't some of the issues that Florida's Latino voters are more interested in things like what's happening in Venezuela and what's happening in Cuba and kind of anti-socialist sentiment?
Yeah, and that speaks to just what an incredibly diverse Hispanic population there is here in Florida. You know, if you go to states like Arizona and Nevada, where the vast majority of the Hispanics are Mexican, Central American, you know, you talk about things like immigration, the economy, healthcare, things like that. But here in Florida, you have the Cuban voters. And for them, you know, a lot of it has come down to one word, and that's socialism. Trump has been bashing that very, very hard. There's, you know, the image of Joe Biden in front of a red background in campaign ads has become a very common thing down here. And so that's something that's resonating. I mean, one of the few demographics in the entire country where Trump is actually doing better this time around is amongst those Cuban American voters, because they've partly because they've been hitting that issue so hard. But at the same time, Cubans used to make up the vast majority of Hispanic voters in Florida, but they're down to a third of that population now. So about another third right now is Puerto Rican voters. You know, it used to be that presidential candidates immediately went to Miami, had their Cuban coffee outside of a Cuban restaurant in Little Havana. But Biden instead went to Central Florida, where there's the majority of Puerto Rican voters. And he's pushing that really hard. He also laid out a very broad plan that he has for Puerto Rico, pushed for statehood, talked about Trump's botched response in Puerto Rico following Hurricane Maria. He sees that as a voting block where he can make more gains.
I have to say that one of the things that I miss this year in the world of COVID-19 is that during the campaign, I can't go to Little Havana and have a coffee or maybe even a Cuban sandwich is also very delicious there. In terms of Trump, though, you know, you mentioned his win in Florida. 113,000 votes was the margin in 2016. But he has said so many offensive things about Latinos, starting with these comments about Mexicans we all remember from 2016. Listen,
they're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. They beat us at the border, people are flowing through, drugs are coming across, pouring across. I'm going to build a wall and Mexico's going to pay for it, right?
His administration has also put immigrants in cages, separated kids from their families. Do Latino supporters in Florida just overlook that history?
I don't know if they overlook it, but there has always been about 25% of Hispanics that are Republicans. And so what we're seeing is the economy is a very important thing to them right now. Healthcare is a very important thing. And so for some of them, yes, those issues along the border and those issues with the treatment of immigrants by the Trump administration do take a back seat to some of their more pressing personal issues that they consider more important.
Alan, what can you tell us about the difference in how the campaigns are trying to get voters out in Florida between door knocking and advertising?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, it's you know, everything obviously is different this year with the pandemic. But down here specifically, what we're hearing a lot is there's been a lot of Democratic finger pointing that there hasn't been enough done down in Florida by the Biden campaign. Again, it's that question of always taking the Hispanic vote for granted. Mm-hmm. You know, the cliche in years past is that the Democratic candidate shows up at the last second with a mariachi band. I guess the 2020 version of that would be Joe Biden playing Despacito, the song by the Puerto Rican singer Luis Fonsi during his campaign stop in Central Florida. And so they're worried that it's taken too long and that they waited too long to get out there.
That is USA Today reporter Alan Gomez in Miami. Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
In the new film Blackbird, Susan Sarandon stars as Lily, a matriarch who gathers her loved ones for a holiday weekend. But this is a gathering like no other. Lily has a terminal disease, and rather than let that disease take its course, she's decided that with the help of her husband, played by Sam Neill, she'll kill herself at the end of the weekend. Lily tries to lessen this blow by joking about her decision. Take this scene where she wakes up some family members who are late for breakfast.
Anna, Chris, you up yet? I'm dead soon. You coming down?
That should do it.
Blackbird opens in theaters and on demand tomorrow. And star Susan Sarandon and director Roger Michel join me now. And for both of you, one thing that immediately came to mind for me watching this film is that aside from why they're gathering, this kind of gathering of family is a lot less possible because of this pandemic.
Well, I think a lot of families have been sort of glued together by the lockdown. And this is a film where, rather like, you know, over the Christmas period or the Thanksgiving period, when the family's all forced to be stuck together for 2 or 3 days, all kinds of exciting and odd things happen.
Susan?
I agree with Roger. I've heard more instances of people, for better or worse, picking up their mother, their grandparent. And I think what the film is also about is how we don't know our parents and we don't know our children as well as we think we do. And some incident like what happens in the film gives us the opportunity or exacerbates the circumstance where suddenly we realize we don't know our parents the way we thought we did. And COVID, I think, has given that opportunity to rediscover your children or your parents. Although I hear a lot of instances where people are driving each other crazy. So, you know, the revelations aren't always easy to take.
Yeah,
it's definitely a mix of both, for sure. This topic is one with so many layers about the choices individuals have in their mortality, how loved ones grapple with that mortality, the dynamics of family trauma, and then suicide. Roger, why did you want to take on this topic?
The subject of euthanasia is not one that's been was particularly high on my list of, you know, fascinating issues before taking on this film. I mean, I think it is a difficult debate. I think euthanasia, well, in Greek, euthanasia means good death, and I think it's hard to come out of watching this particular example of euthanasia without thinking that it's a glorious death, that she's made the right choice and that her family have made the right choice and that Lily has done something full of joy and full of life.
How much research on real cases went into the making of this movie?
We were very lucky to spend time both with a very extraordinary woman who was suffering from ALS, and also with a medical specialist who specializes in dealing with people suffering from ALS, which is a very cruel disease without any kind of palliative cure or any hope. And I think, Susan, I don't know if you'll agree, but meeting both those people had a huge impact on me and my feeling about the subject matter of the film.
Well, when you start to get into the specifics of it, it does become quite terrifying and complicated. But I think there's always been a quiet history of doctors stepping in with the right doctor, the right amount of money, and the right circumstances, and saying, you know, I've been in a situation where they come to you and say, well, this is the moment where we decide whether or not we up the morphine, which is code for kind of ease people that are in their last moments, you know, into a less labored passing, which is nobody talks about and happens a lot.
Susan, I mentioned that Lily is the matriarch of the family, and as it's revealed, also the architect of the family. We can hear it as she lays out plans on how the family is to spend her last day with them. Let's listen.
Can we all try to just behave as normally as possible? Just read the Sunday paper and nap, play the stock market, write a play, make a matchstick model of the Empire State Building, just a normal Sunday. I need to have a normal, lazy Sunday. I need that from you.
How did you prepare for this character, and what drew you to this role?
Well, the fear I had was, why would this seem like a good idea when your family's still in chaos and there are unresolved issues with your children? I would find it personally very difficult at that point to leave. And so Roger and I discussed it, and I think it was important to feel that she's somebody that needs to be in control. And so knowing that she's going to completely lose control is a quality of life decision, and that she was somebody who was very much in her body and needed that. So I think that the control issue is very important to some people. They don't want to be a burden, and they can't surrender to having their very most personal needs taken care of by other people.
Sam has a line in the script, which came straight out of some research I was doing, that most people who elect to go down this road are not depressed. They tend to be very, very competent and quite controlling people. And Lily seems to absolutely personify this.
Can you explain the meaning of Blackbird as a title?
I want to hear this.
Well, Blackbird arrived as a title. At one stage, the script had the Paul McCartney song Blackbird in it, and we decided to cut that. But the title sort of kept coming back. And when we were shooting the film, Susan, I don't know if you remember, but we launched a title competition amongst the cast and crew and got thousands of entries. I think the prize was a crate of champagne or something. And still, nothing quite worked as well as the enigmatic Blackbird. And I put a lot of Blackbird song into the movie. And at the very end of the film, just before we go to the credits, you just hear a solitary Blackbird. So the Blackbird becomes kind of the spirit of Lily and the spirit of the film.
And Susan, you're also known for your political activism. There was a lot of chatter on Twitter recently after you publicly supported socialist Ryan Knight. How do you weigh your persona as an actor with your personal political views?
I don't see any separation. The biggest thing is that I'm a storyteller, and I feel that as someone who's connected to media, that sometimes there's information, sometimes there are stories that are not being heard, and I facilitate that. And the films that I do, I choose because I like the story and the company that I'll be keeping, and I think that they all give me an opportunity to let people develop empathy for someone maybe they hadn't thought about before. At the end of the day, I guess I just have to be able to live with myself. And, you know, sometimes that means standing up in areas for people that don't have a voice, but you really have to speed on the line thing. That just happened. That's great.
It speaks to almost the moment that we're in. I mean, now more than ever, we're asking people to bring the totality of themselves, or we're more open to the totality of a human being. Whereas the past, we wanted people to be certain things, and we thought of things as public lives and private lives. But what you're saying is that it all comes together in what you bring to the world through your craft and your personal ideology.
Well, I'm also saying that, you know, every job you take, no matter what your field is, you know, when that maybe you need to pay attention to what's happening on your school board, you know, as much as what's happening at your job. That I think what we've learned in the midst of COVID is how connected everybody is.
Is this what both of you hope audiences will take away from seeing Blackbird, this sense of empathy and understanding?
Well, I hope everyone calls their mother. I hope they just all say, oh, you know what, I'm going to call my friend because I haven't told her I love her. I think I'm going to take this opportunity to call my sister, who I've hated since she took my sweater in eighth grade and ruined it. I'm going to call her and just tell her that, you know, that was stupid to hold on to that all these years, and let's have lunch. We just need to do more in the moment appreciation of people, more forgiveness in the moment. So let's all hope that people say, let's play dictionary. Let's play some games. Let's dance together. Let's do that.
Roger.
Yeah, I mean, she's put it beautifully. I mean, it's a film about life, not about death. And its message, if it has a message, is, you know, seize the moment. Seize the moment to be alive.
Did you get another tattoo, Roger?
Sorry?
Did you get another tattoo since your tattoo that you got?
No. I've remained totally monogamous on terms of my tattoo. I only have Blackbird.
Oh, you got a Blackbird. You got Blackbird
well,
on
here. We all got tatted at the end of the film. We were all so enamored with our work and each other that we all got Blackbird tattoos, which was very cute.
Blackbird director Roger Michel and star Susan Sarandon. And Susan, I did call my mom after watching this film, so you've done your job in that respect for sure.
Thank you
both for talking with me.
Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the line of a dark black night.
This is Here and Now.
The number of Americans who filed for unemployment benefits last week was 860,000, another drop, but still more than 12 million Americans remain on unemployment benefits. And stocks fell at the open on Wall Street this morning after the Fed said yesterday that interest rates could stay at zero through 2023. Fed Chair Jerome Powell told the news conference that the central bank is committed to maximizing employment, which has fallen during the pandemic. He called the Fed's guidance on interest rates powerful in helping reach that goal.
And today, we believe that particularly this very strong forward guidance, very powerful forward guidance that we've announced today, will provide strong support for the economy. Effectively, we're saying that rates will remain highly accommodative until the economy is far along in its recovery. And that should be a very powerful statement in supporting economic activity.
Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, the Fed said it doesn't expect inflation to rise for years, but it plans to keep those rates at zero even after it does. What should we take away from this latest announcement?
Oh, so the Fed traditionally had been viewing inflation at about 2% as sort of the limit that they would tolerate before they would consider raising interest rates to keep inflation in check. In this case, what they're doing is they're worried that raising rates in an environment of 2% inflation would actually hold back the economy's recovery from this recession this year. So they're willing to let it run, let inflation run above 2% for a little bit because they don't want to be that headwind to the economy. It's important to remember, Jeremy, the rates that the Fed sets are very influential for short-term debt. For longer-term interest rates, they often, or have it at least in the last decade or so, bought longer-term treasuries to keep those longer-term interest rates in check. So I think the disappointment in the stock market is partly because they didn't outline any plans to do that this time, to keep longer-running interest rates low by purchasing longer-term treasuries.
The Fed is not the only central bank in the world. The Bank of England also announced yesterday it was considering cutting interest rates below zero for the first time in its history. What does it mean for the U.S., Mike, when other countries do that, go negative with their interest rates?
Well, one of the first things you have to look for is the currency exchange rates. The currency in a country with higher interest rates tends to strengthen because investors sort of move money to that currency to take advantage of those higher rates. And we did see a little bit of strengthening in the dollar versus the British pound. And that's not necessarily good news for the economy because it makes our exports more expensive to people buying them overseas. So it's something to keep an eye on. And couple that with the fact that most Fed officials have said they do not see the benefit of negative interest rates. For one thing, it does some damage to the banking system and their ability to make profits off of lending. So banks may sort of scale back lending in a negative interest rate environment, and that's not going to be good for the economy. So it's not something the Fed is likely to do here.
Mike, just very briefly, just a few seconds, the latest unemployment numbers, still hundreds of thousands added to the rolls. What do you make of it?
It's still clear that the economy is still struggling to get past this pandemic, and that really puts the onus on Congress in Washington to come to some sort of compromise on the next stimulus package.
If there is one, and if there is one before the election. Mike Regan of Bloomberg News. Okay, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Dance, little DJ, come on.
Valita Carroll is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California, and joins us once again. Hi, Valita.
Hi, Jeremy.
And, you know, we think of Santa Monica as a beautiful, sunny place in California, but right now I know that things are not so great because of the fires and the smoke.
It's not great at all, actually. I haven't really left the house in 4 days now, and only do it in case of an emergency. You can feel it everywhere, and you can see it's looking pretty apocalyptic. Today's a little bit better, but it's like, God, can 2020 bring us any more surprises?
Right, exactly. Well, let's give people a little break from that right now with some of the songs that you have brought us. Maybe they'll provide a little joy. And starting off with Real Magic, this is by Ricky Reed. Ricky Reed is the producer behind tracks like Jason Derulo's Talk Dirty and Lizzo's Good as Hell. Tell us more.
Right. He's been producing stuff for everyone from Sophie Tucker to Leon Bridges, Meghan Trainor, Kesha. I mean, he's the man with, I think, one of the most prolific hit producers in the industry. And he's just released his first album and just gathered all these stars.
Terrace Martin is one of the collaborators on this track.
Yes.
And Terrace Martin has come up in a number of our DJ sessions recently.
And he's also the featured artist on Leon Bridges' Sweeter, which has been a big hit at KCRW. And then St. Panther, who is the voice on this song, and she is an up-and-coming producer from Irvine, so homegrown. And an interesting thing about her is that she was dubbed a top pick on Michelle Obama's podcast playlist. So she got a nod from a pretty influential lady out there.
The next one that you have brought us is Annabelle McGinnis with Blastin' Pastum.
Imagine I'm sitting and I'm laughing, feeling fantastic, calling to collect it, Blastin' Pastum, Blastin' Pastum. Blast and press them. Light. Maybe
happy, but you're the best I ever had. You love me when I'm happy, but you leave me when I'm sad. Under the weather, you know where to be found. Alone, I'm getting better. That's why I imagine I'm sitting and I'm laughing, feeling fantastic, going to galactic blast.
I like that a lot. And Annamelle McGinnis, by the way, is from LA, but describes herself as a bridge between cyborg and celestial.
Right. And that swagger. Oh, my God. She belongs to a pretty awesome collective of artists that comprise Deaf Sound and Tolliver and Zao. And they're kind of like pushing the envelope when it comes to production. But this song, Blastin' Passin', was written before quarantine. And I talked to the artist, and she says that it just feels all too relevant now. It's about imagining beyond our limitations, and, you know, we are very limited right now with what we can do.
Yeah.
But it's also about going beyond what, she says, what compromises us and limits us. It's about accessing the infinite and space travel through our imagination when we're in a situation where we don't feel honored or seen. So it's like, yeah, like a lot of people want to be around us when we're feeling great. But, like, once you show that you're vulnerable and maybe things are not going your way, some people just don't want to deal with that. So she's just like, all right, got to get past that, beyond that, and just, you know,
blast past them.
Exactly, blast past them.
Okay, next up we've got Samia with Pool. Alita, I can tell by your picks today that you're in a very dreamy state right now.
How can you tell, Jeremy?
Tell us more about Samia.
Well, that's another artist I just discovered. She's from Brooklyn, and she is that, you know, quintessential coming of age. Like, here is what young girls early 20s are going through right now. And, you know, 20s were kind of rocky for a lot of us. I don't know about you, but, you know, they're pretty messy for yours truly. So she's making music that feels very homey and expansive, and I just love the sound, and her voice is buttery, and I love how the song starts. If you play from the beginning, there's a little bit of like her grandma calling her, like, Samia, like, it just made me feel very like, oh, I could be in her living room hanging out with her grandma and like talking about all these coming of age songs. So I don't know. It's beautiful.
You know, I have to say, when you describe her voice as buttery, I'm thinking to myself, if you describe something as buttery, whether it is a voice, a wine, or a food, it can't be bad. That's just,
no.
You want it to be more buttery all the time. Let's go to the next one. This is Benny Yurko with You're the Only One. About this one, Benny Yurko from Vermont.
Okay, so, I mean, how often do we hear about artists making lo-fi folk rock music from Vermont? I don't know about you, but this was a big surprise for me. I found this artist via Aquarium Drunkard. It's one of my go-to music blogs, and I guess this guy has been a guitarist for Grace Potter and the Nocturnals, and this is his first solo output in almost a decade, and I just love this pure, dreamy, lo-fi sound, and It's just beautiful. It just puts you in that mood. And, you know, with everything that's going on in the world, like, what's the best way to counter that? With love. That's where I was going with this playlist. I'm just feeling like we just need to put out as many love vibes as possible. And you know how, like, when you were that special person when you're first meeting, like, the world can be falling apart, but like when you're next to them, everything kind of disappears and you're like in that magic zone. So this is what that song is about.
Well, and speaking of putting love out there, we are sending our love out to KCRW, because like so many public radio stations, your station is having financial difficulties and had to say goodbye to a number of people there. So we're thinking of everyone there at this time.
Thank you, Jeremy, so much. And thank you so much for having me. I hope to be back. Who knows? The future seems very uncertain in this moment, but I really do hope to be invited back. And I always look forward to these Here and Now sessions with you.
We will have you back no matter what. Belinda Carroll, a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Thank you so much, as always.
You're so welcome. Take care.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. It's NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Sally isn't a hurricane anymore, but it's dumping torrential rains. 4 months of rain in 4 hours in some parts of the southeast. Hundreds of thousands of people are now without power, and streets have turned into rivers and ripped roofs off of buildings. Coastal Alabama and the Florida Panhandle took the brunt of the storm, and cleanup and recovery efforts are underway there as the storm moves north and east. Joining us now is Dave Dunwoody. He's a reporter at WUWF in Pensacola, Florida. And Dave, Sally made landfall early yesterday morning in Gulf Shores, Alabama, about 50 miles west of where you are. But your city got a tremendous amount of rain. We actually spoke to your mayor about flooding yesterday. What is the situation there today?
Hi, Tanya. Well, it's receded just a little bit, but not so much as you could really tell. Yeah, the rain has stopped, and that's a big plus for people going out and starting their cleanup, both individuals and also government entities. They're able to go out now and assess damage and plan on how to take it up. One of the heroic aspects of all this, there have been more than 500 people rescued from the high water by various agencies, law enforcement, and also 500 National Guard troops. Florida National Guard troops are deployed here with their high water vehicles, helping people get out of harm's way.
Wow. Can you give us a sense, though, of what it actually looks like? Can people get around? Are the streets and roads open or flooded?
It looks a lot like Hurricane Ivan in 2004. Trees down all over the place, power lines, of course, and flooding. But there were lessons learned from Hurricane Ivan that people are applying to Hurricane Sally. A lot of the workers who are out and restoring and getting people out, you know, this isn't their first rodeo, so they know what to do. They have lessons learned from Ivan and Dennis, and a couple of other storms have come in here. So it's more, we have roads open now, power is being restored at a pretty good clip, and the lessons learned from Ivan are benefiting now, because people can get around a lot better than 24 hours ago. And the cleanup and the clearing of roads and like that, it's a lot more expedient.
Yeah, you mentioned that their efforts to restore power. You've actually spoken to the CEO of the Gulf Power Company.
Yeah, and she's new on the job, too. Ironically, Marlene Santos took over just a few months ago as the CEO of Gulf Power, and she spoke this morning at a news conference here in Pensacola.
Last night when we were able to get out, we started our assessments, and we do assessments in different ways. We actually have people that go out and assess our facilities, our lines, and all of that. This morning, we have several drone teams that are out doing aerial footage of our mostly transmission facilities, and then we also have two helicopters out taking a look at everything.
And it's an interesting strategy here because they began in the eastern part of the affected area, and they're working their way back west. And that means a lot of the hospitals, a lot of the law enforcement agencies, people that, you know, have to, you know, serve people who are affected by this storm, they were able to get their electricity back first to where they can now lend a hand.
Yeah, you know, this pandemic has really made a lot of things difficult. Do you see a difference in the way that folks have been able to respond to this storm because of the pandemic?
Well, you see a lot more masks on people, and also there's a lot of the social distancing, and people are being careful about this, too, because they know this is a double whammy, and you really can't take anything. You can't go out there and take anything for granted because, you know, something potentially could happen, so one way or the other. So they are being careful, and more importantly than that, they are getting the job done. It's, like I said, it's a lot faster than after Ivan.
Mm. The area of the Gulf Coast, of course, as you said, with Ivan and so many other storms, folks know what to expect, but the hurricane season is not over. What are you looking forward to as you think about the cleanup and really preparing for other storms?
Well, to be honest, I'm looking forward to November 30th. That's the end of the hurricane season. But yeah, people are on their guard. They're being encouraged and reminded all the time that this is not over. We have about 2.5 months to go before the end of hurricane season, and they are preparing accordingly. They're not taking anything granted. The big challenge here, though, is we have people move here from elsewhere every year. And one of the big challenges for public safety is to bring them up to speed on what to expect, how to prepare, and what to do, you know, in case a storm hits. Because, you know, the public safety obviously is first and foremost in everybody's minds.
Sure. Dave Dunwoody is a reporter for WUWF in Pensacola, Florida. Dave, thank you so much for speaking with us, and stay safe.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
The director of the new Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, argues tech companies have not only manipulated human psychology for profit, but also undermined our sense of reality. Next time on Here and Now.